Challenge children get sedated a lot with medication.
Roland, it's good to have you on podcast. I haven't had you on we talked for a long time. And actually, I'm going to be honest with everybody. Roland and I did it once. We've done the podcast once. It was really long, and he promised this time, as I promised him, that we're going to keep it short and concise because he has a lot of good stuff he wants to tell you. Roland has done so many things since he's been in Japan. He's from Australia, family of five. He has two older sisters, two younger sisters. His mother, unfortunately, just passed away last month at the age of 83. She was just about to turn 84. And father's, he's okay, but he's still having some issues too, but he's 87 now, right?
Yeah, 87.
He grew up very close with his father and his all of his siblings, because they were military, right?
Yeah.
Military. His father's career military person. And I'm talking to you here, but still, let's go to Roland. Let Roland tell you the rest of his story. I don't have to do it. So Roland, you were telling me you traveled all throughout, well, not just Asia. Where else did you go? I know you went to New Zealand was your last place. Your father was posted.
Our last place was in Singapore.
He was posted. Singapore? Yeah. But you didn't go with him then?
I did eventually. I went over to Singapore and did some study in Singapore. Started my career in programming, computer programming.
But you never, because you were going to go in the service, but what happened when you went to the service? I remember, because like I said, we had worked on his first podcast. It was an hour and 40 minutes. So I've been watching that. He was told that he's colorblind, so he had problems with his green and red spectrum and the blue and the yellow, whatever. Mm. So he had problems with
green
that.
And red.
The green and red, and he said, okay. I didn't really want to go anyway, so he went on, and you traveled around for a while.
Yeah, I did a lot of travel. I mean, it was adventure, you know, for me, very much a spirit of adventure. So I went out and did various jobs and traveled throughout Australia, traveled throughout Southeast Asia, and then eventually went back to Singapore where my father was stationed, and so I said, well, I better get back to study, and started studying.
But tell me this, when you did the travels, were you doing this alone?
Yeah.
You went alone?
Alone, yeah.
That is wild. How old were you when you were doing this? You had to be, what, 17, 18?
18, yeah. 18 years old, yeah.
Well, okay, we have the same kind of spirit, because when I was 18, I was going to ride from Los Angeles to New York and back on my Honda 750.
Yeah.
And 2 weeks before going, I met a guy that had a Honda 550, which they stopped making. It had four cylinders too. And he asked, could he go all the way with me? Because he wanted to go to Evansville, which was midway. So he rode with me across. We rode back, stopped down in Evansville, and then rode back. And I never saw him after that. After those, I think it was a 3 week total trip.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it was interesting.
Yeah, I think, those journeys really build your personality, but also build your skills in terms of just being able to adapt to the environments, and you learn so much. I couldn't speak, obviously, Malay or Thai or Burmese, the countries we went through.
You say we went through.
Oh, I went through. Sorry,
okay, right.
But I went through.
Right, okay.
But you often sort of meet somebody along and you travel
doing the same
with
thing
them.
They travel. Okay, yeah, so you did that. That's neat.
That was a great experience. Like,
but
I
the
really
amount of confidence that you build up, that the society has, not say consciously tried to do, but constantly telling you what you can't do.
True.
And be safe.
True.
And that's drummed into us for good reasons.
Yeah.
Because it's based upon the bad things people have seen.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, in spite of all that, I'm going to go take a try and see what happens.
Yeah, that's right. It was a bit of a, you know, go wild or free, you know, young and free sort of a
did you have any times during your travels that you really did think, uh-oh, something bad's going to happen, or this and that? Did you have any?
Oh, you always have those.
Well, what was it? What was something that you remember?
Well, I was on I was in a town called Misai, which was on the Malay-Thai border, way up the top, and sort of just north-east from the Golden Triangle. And I'd gone out for dinner that night. And I was staying at a local guest house. And I'd come home, or I'd come back to the room, and all my stuff had sort of been gone through, and all my traveler's checks had gone. And luckily, I had the passport with me. But there I was, stuck on this small little town way out in the middle of nowhere. And I was trying to find out, well, how do I go and find the culprit, because typically what happened in the evenings, because the river between Thailand and Burma at the time, now Myanmar, was very shallow. So people would just kind of walk across the local farmers and then go find out where the foreigners are staying and go through this stuff and take
stuff. Found this out later, yeah.
And so that basically I got, you know, hit by one of those crews. So I was there with no money right on the border, sort of. Then I had to realize, how do you work systems? How do you get money transferred to somewhere in the middle of nowhere, you know, and sort of go through that process. And as I was walking down to the police station, I realized how important it is to learn to communicate and go through this exercise with particularly getting the police to take some sort of empathy of your situation.
How'd you do? What happened?
I ate bananas for about 2 weeks while I was waiting for money to get transferred from Australia. I eventually contacted my sister and said, can you send me some money, please? And she sent some money over.
How'd you get money to do that, to be able to call? Did you call her, or did you?
Yeah, collect call. So I collect call back.
Oh, I got it. Okay.
So I collect call back. She got some money, and in the meantime, I didn't have any money, so I ate bananas for 2 weeks.
But and did you get real skinny? Did you ever get sick?
I got really
anything?
Skinny, yeah.
You get sick or anything?
No, it was all right. And then basically the money came and sort of went out and got seriously drunk after that. But with a local police guy, because I did owe him a local favor, and we had a good,
night.
It was a good, yeah. But it was a sort of one of those experiences where you're sort of stuck in the middle of nowhere and you really had to sort of think about how do you get yourself out of this awkward situation, particularly being 18 years old and I've never been in sort of that sort of situation. Because like what you said, you have the environment,
that's
you're
right.
well protected. But if you do throw yourselves into those environments, it really goes back to what your parents have taught you as a child.
That's right.
How you've been brought up and sort of, you know, what sort of skills do you really have?
This is something I found out too, because I was going across the states at a time when there still was a lot of social unrest. When I went through, it was in the 70s.
Yeah.
And we just got through having some riots and stuff like that in the major cities. The thing I found out, I don't know if it was the same with you, how kind people really are. It doesn't matter their ethnicity. Okay, so Roland, I know there's a subject that you're really passionate about. But first tell me, wait, so you finished college. When you finished college, how old were you when you finished? Because you didn't go to the service.
I didn't go to the service. I sort of did a series of jobs and sort of, I think the key thing is the trip to Japan, getting to Japan in 87. Because I really like to study. I really enjoy studying and learning, but I was sort of broke and didn't really want to go back to my parents and say, oh, look, can you lend me some money for college and all that sort of thing. They would have supported me, no doubt. But yeah, I really wanted to do all this sort of by myself. It's kind of like, I don't know. You know, the son who's gone off and sort of
the only son
made his way sort of thing.
Right.
But I came to Japan in 87 and you know, I started to work in my professional career.
Now, do you did this on your own too? You came to Japan just because you wanted to, or what?
Yes, very much so. Well, I did have a partner at the time.
Okay.
And she studied Japanese under her Asian mate. Her major was Japanese.
Right.
So we came just at the bubble period in 87. And you know, initially I started studying martial arts because I thought it was a quick way to learn Japanese. But there's a lot of other things you learn, obviously, if you're thrown into it. So I jumped into a Aikido dojo in Shinjuku. This was with a very famous Japanese sensei, Shiodo Gozo. He is renowned for developing a particular style of Aikido. And if you know, Aikido is a derivative of Jiu-Jitsu, but it's a very much a non-competition based martial art. And funny enough, it was considered a more gentle style of martial art, but at this particular dojo, they taught the Japanese Metropolitan Riot Police, which wasn't very gentle at all.
Right.
And what they did was they gave them a sort of an intensive one-year program so that they could pick up all these techniques and then sort of go off and maybe teach them to their cadets later on. But it was also part of a career path for them, from what we understand. So there's 10 each year. So I joined that course in 88, and it was the 25th Japanese Riot Police course, Metropolitan Police. And that was pretty intense.
And how many foreigners were with you? How many other
foreigners? There were three.
And you guys were used as the, instead of having the little strong man and stuff.
But I mean, like, it was obviously, they wanted to, you know, I mean, if Japanese do it the Japanese way, foreigners do it a very foreign way.
So they wanted to test you with, to use you for that.
But it was a lot of fun. I mean, like, those guys were great guys. I mean, they're still very good friends. Most of them have gone and graduated and had wonderful careers in the police. But it was a pretty intense 1 year. But graduated and then went back into trying to earn some money to make a living. Okay. But it was a good testing ground to actually, one, understand a lot about Japan and sort of those cultural structures that are needed to survive. You know, the hierarchy.
That's right.
But collectivism.
But that doesn't apply to you.
I had to apply myself to it.
But still,
make sure I could survive in that environment.
For the time that you're going to be a part of it.
You have to understand it and then sort of use.
That's right. Use your gaijinness to be able to get around certain things. Like I'm sorry, I didn't really understand. I didn't know.
Well, you can do that.
That's right.
Baka gaijin.
Well, it worked for me for a while. Mm. It worked for a while, like whenever you got traffic tickets and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They used to really work well. But you try it now.
No.
And what they do is they pull out their phone, they say it in Japanese, tap it, show you in English.
You can't get away with it anymore.
I had to laugh the first time that happened. So you stayed, you never left Japan after that, right?
No, I didn't. I stayed.
What kept you here?
Family.
You didn't get married right away after your partner. You had a partner, I know that, and she was Australian.
She was Australian.
Was she Australian?
She still is, I.
Okay, wait.
I haven't been in contact with her since, but, you know, she went back to Australia. Her mum got sick, and then, you know, obviously the bubble, and I was quite busy. She was looking after her mother. You know, long-distance relationships are always tough, and, you know, I was, you know, trying to be as faithful as I could, but the bubble had a lot of distractions, so let's put it that way.
It did, most definitely.
But anyway,
I was fortunate
to find a lovely Japanese lady who had bad taste in men. So Yuko eventually succumbed to my
wisdom. She's your wife now, right?
So yeah, she's.
We've been married for 30 years.
Yeah, four weekends. Yeah.
My wife did too, and I was talking about that last night. Yeah. And she was looking at me, and I was looking at the way she looked at me. Your wife looked at you like, did I really let this guy have four kids? She looked at me like that. Because I was telling her, I really wanted to have four girls. Because I'm raised by a man, and I wanted to know that side of me. Be a nicer, you know, because you could spoil your girls and be really cute, you know, and everything. But I ended up with four boys.
You ended up with four boys.
Yeah. I'm happy with them, but I still wanted that. Now I'm going to be a grandfather in February, so.
Oh, congratulations.
And it's going to be a girl.
Well, I've got girl boy.
That's right.
You were lucky, very lucky.
You are.
Yeah.
And three of them were in my class. The first wasn't. That gets us to something very interesting.
Well, Yudi, yes.
Yeah, because we're talking about. But your first daughter, she was challenged as a child because of the way she was born, right?
And this is something that I think that most parents, when you start that journey, you know, your wife is pregnant, it's very exciting, it's a wonderful time of your life. But then if something does go wrong at birth, what happens, you know, both for your wife, you know, there's a lot of risks.
What happened, especially in Japan too, because challenged kids for the longest, and still in some cases are shunned. They're hidden from society here. This is not really accepted.
A veil of shame.
Right.
That they sort of used to describe how Japan approaches, you know, this concept.
They have nothing to do with it. It's just something missing chromosome or whatever it could be. But what happened in your case? What was?
Well, Yudi was born in a hypoxic state. She, the labor was very long, so Yuko and her were battling away to give birth to Yudi. But the umbilical cord was caught around her neck, and they tried to move her, and things get a little bit complicated. But she was born, and she was in a hypoxic state, so a lack of oxygen. She didn't breathe immediately. The doctors tried to resuscitate her. Eventually resuscitated her, but she had to go into emergency care immediately. So we rushed down to, we were at a midwife center.
Not in Tokyo?
In Tokyo, in Itabashi. So we had to rush her down to the Red Cross hospital.
In Hiro.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so she was admitted, and very, very worrying, nervous time. for that night. So I basically stayed at the hospital waiting to find the diagnosis of what had happened.
So you still didn't have a clue what had happened?
No, I didn't
know. Or what state she was in, the child?
Correct, yeah. So I went home
But it had already been of course, your child was delivered.
Yes. So she was a normal baby, you know, arms and legs and all that sort of stuff. But she's just had that sort of, that challenge of, you know, breathing, coming to life, and that sort of grasp
of,
you know, air to kickstart all the systems in her body and all that sort of stuff. So the next day I went back, the doctor said, look, we're not getting a lot of signals from the brain. Your daughter may have a severe brain injury. And the diagnostics after that weren't very good, you know. So the next day, visited the doctors again, and you know, Yudi had improved, but the doctor was still warning us about a brain injury, and that maybe it might be as severe as she's going to be basically bedridden for most of her life.
They had told you that.
Yeah. So it was a bit.
So
of
you're
shock.
Preparing you for the worst, the worst possibly. Yeah. Yes.
And. Yeah, it was, because I mean, like, it's a matter of just one day after the other. You sort of, you're on a bit of a roller coaster. And then, you know, obviously the doctors are pragmatic, and they say, well, look, you know, if you think it's going to be too difficult for the family, they offer you sort of some sort of decision that you could make at that particular point.
What's the decision you could make?
You could take her off life support, because she was on that critical situation.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
And I can imagine.
It's sort of one of those very, I don't know, you never want to replay that, but you never want to sort of, you get put in that situation, where's your morals, where's your compass on this, you know, everything goes through your head at once. It's like pretty confusing. Basically, I said to him, look, there's no way you're going to take her off life support, that we're going to have her, we're going to take her home. And I remember saying that quite clearly. I didn't know really what was going to happen.
But it didn't matter. This is your child, you're going to keep her, and you're going to make it work.
So he kind of nodded his head, he went away, and then after that, we just you know, had to go on a different journey. You know, we were expecting this journey of taking the UD to high school, you know, primary school, high school, and all that sort of stuff.
So what was it like as a foreigner here? This is in your country. So you couldn't be facilitated so easily. Language had to be part of a challenge too.
Yeah.
But more than that, as soon as they see you, you're not Japanese. You're not going to get the same kind of care. How'd you deal with this?
You have to do a lot of research. You have to really, and then this goes back to really parenting and the responsibility around parenting, because I guess a lot of people just sort of hand over a lot of the bulk of the load to the schools and sort of do the weekend bit, maybe, you know.
Right, I understand.
And the mums are perhaps, or the dads, or whoever the partner's at home, would be doing the other bit, or the nanny, or whatever. But when you sort of have to look at a situation where you get a symptomatic assessment of your child, so the doctors came out and they said, diagnose her, she's going to have cerebral palsy. What's that?
You mean, of course,
like,
yeah, it was not
like,
no.
All right, it's a symptomatic description, but what is it? How do you fix it? You know, what do we do? Where is the problem and all that? They don't give you that information because as a parent, you want to obviously help child as much as you can. So you've got to really take ownership of it, I think, lads. And in Japan, it's even more challenging because I think the services around supporting how people address or support children with challenges is very limited. In the 90s at the time, it was sort of akin to the US in the maybe 70s. It was like 10 or 15 years behind. Mm-hmm. They've since sort of greatly accelerated the services
with the help of
and choices.
Organizations
and like
yours, yeah.
But definitely it was difficult. So at that time in the 90s, we sort of went back to the US and we found a great sort of institute to work with in the US.
But you just went back to find the institutes and then you came back here.
Yeah, we were based here. And so we had to come up with a program of, you know, a lot of children with challenges, and no matter what, there's a huge spectrum from paralysis right through to maybe attention disorder or whatever it may be, and all of us sit somewhere along there as well.
That's true.
We're all on that sort
right.
of spectrum.
Right.
But often, challenged children get sedated a lot with medication, right?
And to make it easier, to say for the parent.
For the parent.
Whoever the caretaker
is. Keep the child safe. Maybe the child has fits or something like that. But one thing it does do, which is perhaps particularly with brain injury, it really sedates the child, but it also sedates the nervous system. And the nervous system is one of the key sort of tools to really activate the brain. You know, your touch, sight, taste, hearing, all that goes into the brain, and it all stimulates all the pathways and the neurons throughout the brain.
But there's one thing you said. You said you had to study about this. You didn't know this right away, and no doctor's telling you this.
No, that's
right. So where did you get this information? How did you find about it?
We went to the institutes in the U.S., and there was one, the Glenn Dorman's Institute.
Okay.
Which was the Institute for the Achievement of Human Potential,
and they weren't into sedating their kids.
No, they definitely wanted to take children non-medicated programs.
Right,
so
okay.
they sort of like looked at what the child's diagnosis is, and then built a program around that, but tried to keep it as drug-free, but family-orientated. And sort of looked at natural sort of methods as much as possible. So just good nutrition, good physical exercise, consistent, focused attention, all that stimulation.
And they're still doing that. They still
doing
do this.
It, yeah.
And what's the name of the institution again?
The Institutions for the Achievement of Human Potential.
They made it up there.
I mean, you make that shorter or something.
So that takes me into one more thing. So. Not only did you find out about that and then have to regiment your schedule with your wives, because she was professional too, wasn't she?
No, well, she stayed at home.
She stayed at home.
Yeah.
But then you made sure that your time fit around that, right?
Yeah, Yugo's the real sort of captain, lord, king, god,
how'd that work?
And master of the universe. She was really the core of the family, I think.
How did it work? How did she set it up?
We had to both graduate from these series of programs at
Which
the
is
institute.
How many? How long
it was about
is it?
Four programs. So I went over to the US and studied and came back. And they have a great program, which is what to do with your brain injured child. And you go through all these other courses. And then what you do is you put together a home program. And it's sort of.
And then you still coordinate with them while you're at home.
And they're sort of a consultant on the side. And they give you all this input and then you create all this data and you track the data.
Now, how much time were you there? How much time did you have to stay in the States to take this course?
I was there for a good month and a bit.
Okay, so someone had a month that they could take off, they could go do this.
Yeah. And they do courses over here as well. They come over here and do that. But and there's a great network in Japan of people that, like us, went through this program, and very famous people, all sorts of people. And everybody struggles, right, to obviously think about what would you do or how do you support your child.
Right.
In Japan, a lot of people, both for the resources that they have, both economically, they've got not so much money, and then for time-wise, and then perhaps their personality or just who they are as a person, they just can't deal with the situation. but if they were able to understand that there are good sort of networks out there to support you, I think a lot more people would get on to this program of, say, supporting the children. Because if you get in and support children at an early age, all kids are intelligent,
right
from day one.
That's
we were talking about before.
But we should fast forward to one thing, fast forward to where we are right now. Now, your daughter had all these issues, and this is a lifelong thing. She still has
paralysis
of her right side because of this, right? What just recently happened as a result?
She got married. She got married down in Nogizaka, Jinja, just down the road.
Now, how did you? Did she have any speech impediments because of
this?
She
still does. Yeah.
She still does.
She still does. Yeah.
But her cognitive abilities are really up
really
to
sharp.
Par?
Really sharp. So it's a midbrain. Here's part of the diagnosis. And she said, "Well, what's cerebral palsy?"
Right.
So we had to study that. All right, the injury is in the midbrain. It's diffuse, so it's scattered across the midbrain, but it's mostly on the left hemisphere.
And it could vary from person to person.
And each child is uniquely different, as you would expect.
Right.
And so you had to kind of like figure out a program that, you know, supported or supplemented the development of the brain, because the brain is like a muscle and it grows and it replenishes itself. But then looking at the sort of the issues on her right side of her body, how do you help her get the skills and basically relearn how to use her body? It's not perfect, but there's a lot of science every year, right, getting better and better.
And she still continually work on her program?
Yeah.
And she's married. So how'd you get along with her husband?
Very good. I was a bit nervous, to be honest.
But how did they meet? She's not going to a regular school or anything. How old is your daughter now? How old is she?
30.
She's 30?
Yeah.
So how did they meet?
Well, we went through a very long program with the Dorman and the Institute, and then sort of put Yudi, she wanted to go to school. She wanted to have friends. She wanted to have this very much a girl's sort of network of friends and be able to talk about, you know, these wonderful singers, you know, these.
Everything, yeah.
I can't remember the name of her famous singer, but anyway. So we sent her to school and they had a special ed program. So we put her in with a special ed program here in Tokyo.
Here in Tokyo. Okay.
But then we realized as kids grow up, you know, they always are kids, right? And they don't know how to interact. They don't know what values and morals. They're sort of learning all that as they're growing. And so she was teased quite a lot at the school.
How old was she when she went to school?
She started school when she was six, seven.
Oh, so you put her in school right away. Okay, so she was normal with other kids, same
time. We believed in integration, you know, trying to integrate, you know, children and Yudi still had a lot of therapy at home after school, like physical therapy, occupational therapy, and things like that. But eventually the school closed down its special ed program, and then we went through homeschooling. And then after that we said, right, now we've got to try and give her a really look at her long-term prospects. And we got to a conclusion that Australia offered the best long-term prospects for her. Not only because it has a very good welfare structure, but the education system was more supported. So we put her into an Australian school with a very good special ed program.
It's a boarding school, obviously.
Yeah, she stayed with my parents.
Oh, with your parents?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was wonderful.
Oh, so your parents were, okay, that's interesting.
It was fantastic.
From 7 on or from 8 on?
No, this was from 14 years old.
So she's close to your mother and father.
Yeah, Dad loved her. I said to Dad, it was a big ask, and I loved him for this, but, I mean, because he was in the army, right? But he had somebody that he could kind of work with and develop, and he had they had a special bond in the end of it.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And she graduated from high school down in Australia, and then wanted to work, so we helped her find her a job in the local community and supported her, and then, you know, set her up in an apartment. So she started to live by herself, and then through online chat she met Aidan.
Yeah,
and then they started.
A strapping young man. Yeah, he's
Australian. But he works in the Air Force
with a beard. I'm
saying he's in the Australian Air Force.
Yeah,
So they got married last month.
Oh,
in Nogizaka Jinja. So it was a journey that.
But did he come? He came to meet you before he got married.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. Did you? How were you? Were you nice? Or were you kind of?
It's hard to know what you're like on that perspective.
Right?
They're looking at you.
Yeah, how they look at you, but you think you're being nice.
I say one thing, it's taken completely out of context, I think, sometimes. But
wow. So you're now the chairman of the FCSC, which stands for the Foreign Community Support
Team Committee.
Committee.
Now, let me just correct you there, Lance. The Foreign Community Supporting Committee was established back in 1957.
I know what you're going to tell me. No, I remember, because I was a part of it.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
Now we changed the name. Now it's called UP.
That's right, Unleashed Potential.
Unleashed Potential, yeah. Right. Yeah. And it's UP now, because I was a part of it just as you were starting to go through the name change.
Yeah.
And they decided, and I think that was really good, you and Midori. And
that's right, we've got Midori Kaneko, wonderful, wonderful lady. She's had a lot of involvement around the Tokyo community. She's always been a member. Longer than me, I think, late 90s.
Yeah, she's been a member for a long time.
Marco Crivelli,
right?
Good old Marco.
Yeah, there,
he's been managing companies in Japan for, I don't know, for years and does a wonderful job.
I have to get on. I've had Midori on the podcast.
Right.
We didn't talk about it up. I think she might have mentioned it for a second. She was talking about the new hotel she's helping to build and work on. And Marco, I need to get him on.
Yeah.
Marco.
Yeah.
And who else?
Well, you'd know quite a few people.
I know a lot of people. Yeah, you have a lot of people that have been on there. And I know that it started in the early days, I think, with people like Bob Collins, who used to be president here.
That's right.
You had him on there. And then Chuck Wilson, who's still around.
Yes.
And he was my best man in my marriage.
Yeah.
I got married, Chuck and I, and he's been on the podcast.
Well, Chuck was quite famous for starting charity runs.
Most definitely. He's the one that designed all that and got it going. He sure did. And got it throughout Japan, not just here.
Yeah.
He did it all over. I made a lot of money. So tell me, so what made you decide to get, I mean, of course, your daughter made you decide to get involved, but what are you doing now with UP? Could you tell me some of the things that are happening?
Well, we went through that process. The FCFC had sort of been moving or sort of like a social network of, you know, business people that wanted to contribute back into the community in Japan. So there's a letter program. They'd raise money and they'd give that money to build orphanages or buy books for schools. And then in the sort of 90s, with Chuck's influence, it sort of moved towards focusing on children and then challenged children with the YMCA. And so there was a close contact, connection with the YMCA.
And let's not leave out Nick Massey, who was a very big influence apart. Yeah,
yeah, Nick.
He was almost definitely.
I think more than 10 years.
He he did. He got an award as a result of that, too. Yeah,
the best volunteer in Tokyo. So
for sure.
Really some amazing people have been part of that. And you know, ambassadors as well.
That's right. Ambassador Many of the ambassadors have been involved. You had the Australian ambassador.
Yeah, Bruce Miller, over there, right. McCarthy. Yeah.
And I think you had the Canadian ambassador as well that got involved. Yes.
And I think through those connections, you know, a lot of them have expanded their network in areas where they wouldn't have expected they would have had made friends.
That's right.
And so we sort of, that organization was slowly starting to sort of come to an end in terms of its impact. You know, it was difficult to get charitable contributions by letters, et cetera, et cetera. So we said, well, look, you know, let's set up an NPO. So I spoke to the board and said, well, let's set up an NPO. And we did that in 2021. And I took the chairmanship initially on that. And now I've handed that over now to Hiromi Sakamaki, lovely lady. And we have Paul Savesi. I think Savesi, so apology, Paul's, I'm sort of not pronouncing your name right.
Oh, but you mean, that's right, Paul Savesi, you mean, and he's over the, he's been on the podcast too, and he's over the New Sano Hotel.
That's right.
He's general manager there, yeah.
So wonderful people, amazing things. So.
And the truth is, many of them don't have children in their family that have any kind of challenges.
That's right.
That's really interesting because you can you understand, of course, you think when someone had that, they'd have more empathy and understand the issues going through, but many of these people don't have that issue at all.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that reach out, giving something to the community, I mean, it's such a powerful, you know, emotional benefit. And I don't like to call it a benefit, but it's just sort of something that enriches your time in Tokyo. And if more people would like to reach out, definitely contact Unleashed Potential.
That's right. I'll make sure that we have that underneath in your description and stuff and put that down there, how they can contact. Yeah. Well, listen, we're going to end the podcast kind of short, but I want to ask you this. I asked you before, and you told me not to ask you again, but I'm going to ask you this anyway.
I think you, it all would be different, right?
It could be different every time because no one saw the first time. But if you could magically go back in time and meet the younger Roland, what advice would you give him and how old would he be?
Because I've had some time to think about this.
Okay, again, that's right. Well,
I did say in reply last one, so more gratitude, but I thought about it again. So what is gratitude sort of really given? And I came up with amor fati.
Amor fati.
Amor fati, and which means in Latin, love your fate, love your fate. So the sort of idea that, you know, you think your life is going to turn out whatever you sort of believe it should be, but actually life just gives you whatever you get, right? And so you don't know what you're going to get. And the situation when I thought back about Yuri, you know, is really a huge benefit for our family, and, you know, the way that she has shown courage and perseverance and tenacity to get on with her life. And, you know, I asked her, you know, she sometimes said on her birthday once, she said, you know, Dad, and this was on her birthday on the 25th of September, she said, Dad, this was the day that I was born perfect, you know, and when she was born. And she said, but I wouldn't change it for what she's done now. So what she's done, and I don't have any.
Did you have a tear in your eye when she said,
absolutely.
Oh man, you almost put one in mine now.
But I wouldn't change that, you know.
No, you can't.
You
come
can't.
On.
And I think so. I can't have an excuse if she's going to be able to sort of push through her challenges. So definitely that was, amor fiti. So,
amor fiti.
Yeah, love your fate. I think it's the best way to wrap it up.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lance.
I want to thank all of you for watching and listening. Make sure you never forget, it's all on loan, so continue to reach for the stars.
Because you're too blessed to be stressed.